Welcome to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out NHHCA.org. Appreciate joining us for the show that is all about the First of the Nation presidential primary. We have interviews coming up on the show with Andrew Yang, Pete Buttigieg, Marianne Williamson, and Amy Klobuchar. We'll also talk about the third round of debates. 10 candidates will be on the stage as the cut has been made for that. And as a result of not making the stage after proclaiming that she would, Kirsten Gillibrand, senator from New York, who has spent a lot of time in New Hampshire and campaigned over the last 8 months, has decided to call it quits, leaving the race via a video message, and she has decided not to continue on. She was on the show, of course, and talked about the fact that she was going to make the debates and did not, of course, and she kind of set her own deadline there where I thought, you know, she was going to push hard to get in. If she didn't, she was going to leave the race, and in fact, she did, Paul.
That's right. So what were the criteria needed? 130,000 contributions, campaign contributions from individual donors, plus 2% at four qualifying polls, polls that the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, deemed met their criteria. Steyer was one poll short. He didn't get it in either of the two new polls that came out yesterday from Quinnipiac University and from USA Today and Suffolk University. Gabbard needed to be at 2% in both those polls, wasn't there. And Gillibrand needed three polls, so she wasn't going. And she hadn't reached 130,000 contributors yet. So we've got 10 candidates. Who are they? Former Vice President Joe Biden will be on the stage. Senators Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Bernie Sanders of Vermont, Cory Booker of New Jersey, Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota. They'll all be there. Who else will be there? Pete Buttigieg, the South Bend, Indiana mayor. Former Congressman Beto O'Rourke of Texas, and Andrew Yang. How about that?
I was wondering if you're going to get there, if we're going to have a Rick Perry moment here.
No.
I have to help you get you through two candidates at the end. But you made it.
I made it. I got Yang in there. You mentioned Kamala Harris of California. Yes, she is in, of course. She's been polling around anywhere from 5 to 7% in all these recent surveys. And also, I left out Julian Castro, the former HUD secretary under President Barack Obama, and before that, mayor of San Antonio.
And we're going to hear from Andrew Yang in just a little bit here on the show. And Yang is an individual who has had a lot of upwards movement as of late. There's some question as to where things sit at the top of the race. You know, as we've talked about before, the math is very much in Joe Biden's favor at this point in time. He is occupying a center lane that is one that doesn't really have a lot of challenge coming from the right or from the center for Biden's perch in this race.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Listen, there was a poll that came out at the beginning of this week from Monmouth University. What did it show? Biden tied with Sanders and Warren. And that was immediately put the Biden campaign in action, reaching out to national reporters across the country. They reached out to me a number of times for stories that we all did on that poll. They said it was an outlier. Well, guess what? They were right. Because the two new polls that came out since then showed what everything else has shown before, that Biden remains the clear front runner and that Warren and Sanders are pretty much all tied up for second place. Mm-hmm. And the pollster agreed himself yesterday coming out and saying, yeah, we were an outlier. And you don't see pollsters saying that very much, but Patrick Murray, the pollster for Monmouth University, did that. So it was a rare moment for a pollster to come out and admit that. But yeah, going into this next round of debates, this third round, and Biden remains the clear frontrunner, even though he's had a number of slip-ups, a number of gaffes, including some right here in New Hampshire just last week. He remains on top. Warren is kind of cemented, or at least is slightly moving ahead of Sanders now. Slightly. Those two new polls that came out yesterday from Quinnipiac University and from Suffolk University show that. But remember, these are all national polls. This is a race for the states and the delegates in the states. So I wouldn't put too much stock into that. We still have a little over 5 months to go until the voting actually begins.
And again, though, the math, despite Biden's gaffes, despite the perception that he may not be as up for the task as some people may have thought at the beginning, the math is still so much in his favor because of how far left the other candidates have gone at this point. And I still think that there's a final four, if you will, in this race. And that fourth spot is still up for grabs. You know, we've seen Kamala Harris rise at times. We've seen Pete Buttigieg rise at times. Beto O'Rourke rise at times. There is a thirst for something new, a new generation of politics, a new generation of leadership. But there has not really been a coalescence around a particular individual. The progressive energy, that's been, you know, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have really been able to lock that up. Old school progressives. And that has been a consistent theme really throughout the last number of months. But there, in my view, still is that opportunity for that new leader to emerge. And I think a lot of individuals are looking at that and wondering who that's going to be. And can they somehow move to a place where individuals who are considering voting for Biden or say they're going to vote for Biden move over into that lane of new leadership?
It's a great point. It's a great point. You know, one other thing we should talk about going forward here is that what happens to the other 10 to 12 candidates who didn't make the thresholds? Well, some of them are going to stick around because guess what? There's going to be a fourth round of debates in early October. Same criteria. So you know Steyer's going to stay in. A, he's got the money. B, he's going to make
He's going to find a poll. I'm surprised that he didn't do it this time. Very surprised.
Very surprised. Gabbard's going to stay in as well. She needs two polls. What does Gillibrand do? She has said she vowed that she was going to make this third round of debates. She'll hit the polling criteria most likely and the fundraising criteria. So I don't see her giving up yet. Some of the others, though, who are longer shots, who may not even make the fourth round, even if they have another month to do it, are vowing to stay in. John Delaney, the former congressman from Maryland, who's also self-financing his campaign, says he's staying in. Tim Ryan told us just the other day, the Ohio congressman, he's staying in.
Bennett and Bullock have said they're staying in.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see, though, that some of these longer shot, lower tier candidates, I don't know. I know they're saying now they're going to stay in. Let's see if that really comes to fruition.
Right, and, you know, Chris Saliza was writing about the fact that this is going to be the time when the candidates start to fold, and I don't think so. I don't think we're going to see a lot of candidates drop out as a result of this right now. I mean, it may be a slow march to them dropping out of the race in a month or two, but I think that the candidates are going to try to stay in and get to that fourth round. Then is where I think we start to see candidates drop out at a greater number. The only person that really set this as kind of the end for them is Gillibrand, because Gillibrand said she was going to make the debate, and now she hasn't. So now what? I mean,
Does she stick it out for one more month?
Right.
Because she is close. She's closer than almost anybody else we just talked about. She's almost there for the 130,000 donations, and she needs three more polls, which in a month you think. But for some of these candidates, yeah, we give them another month, but if they don't make the fourth round of debates by the middle of the end of September, they've seen the writing on the wall. It's really time to go.
I agree. I mean, I think we're about a month out for those candidates, and if they're unable to move forward and to get to the threshold, despite what they think may be unfair or whatever their rationale may be, the rules are the rules, mm-hmm. and there's only so long you can continue on and fund your staff and keep an operation moving forward.
Delaney's about the only one who could march on because, again, he's self-funds. He doesn't have a huge staff. But, yeah, because let's be honest, the sources at the DNC have told me that for the next round of debates in November, criteria are going to go up again. For the fifth round. So if you're struggling right now to make the third or fourth, you are not going to be making the fifth.
That is Paul Steinhauser. I am Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. When we come back, Andrew Yang, he has been a story as of late, really good energy on the ground. He is rising in the polls, and he is on the debate stage when many governors and senators have either not made it or decided to pack it up and go home. The political novice, Andrew Yang, when we return. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Andrew Yang was in the state this week on Sunday as well as Monday. His major focus was on climate change, and he laid out a policy proposal in regards to climate change on the seacoast.
Yeah, it was a beautiful, idyllic situation there. He was right under the Memorial Bridge with the Portsmouth Harbor and the Piscataqua River right behind him on a gorgeous, nice, cool summer day. Couldn't have picked a better spot to do it. Yang is a great story. And Chris, Yang when we talked to him, he points out that we were one of the first to interview him way back in March of last year when he first jumped into the race, when he was a nobody. Nobody in the political world knew who he was. So I had to look it up.
Right.
He's come a long way since then. He's had a surge in recent months, partially because of his freedom dividend, which is that universal basic income. He's pushing $1,000 for every adult American each month. Look at the last two polls that came out yesterday. Yang is at 3%, so just below the top tier, but ahead of most of the rest of the field. He's on the move, and we both had a chance to talk to him, as you said. And I started by asking him how the heck he's going to get all this passed if he becomes president. Take a listen.
You're going to pay for all this with your value-added tax. How do you get that passed through Congress? You know, you talked about if you win the election, that you'd have the support of the people. Barack Obama had the support of the people in 2008 in a big landslide victory. He couldn't get much of his agenda passed.
Well, if you look back, they rallied all their energy around the healthcare system, which was the choice that they made. I would rally all of our energy around dividend for the people and then accelerating our progress on climate change. And there is a great deal of consensus around both those issues, particularly as they would both, in many cases, return money to Americans themselves.
Some of the other rivals right now for the nomination, a lot of the long shots, a lot of the lower tier candidates are complaining about the DNC's criteria. They're probably not going to reach it by the middle of this week. Is that sour grapes, or do they have a point here?
I'm a bit biased because I'm making the fall debates, and so I think the rules are fine. I will say that the rules have been out there for us all to see for months, and that if you were going to complain about the criteria, you probably would want to complain about it a little bit earlier in the process to make it seem like it's not purely self-interested. But I think the DNC has been very fair and open and transparent.
You've come a long way. Now you're almost to the top tier. Do you worry, though, that the media sometimes still doesn't take you seriously? Just the other day, Chris Cillizza not putting you in his
top 10.
Power
We're
pits.
Gonna make Chris. Yeah, Chris, if you're watching this,
but
you're gonna look pretty bad in just a minute.
But is it more than just him? Are you concerned that the media, for whatever reason, still isn't taking you serious because you've never been a politician before?
You know, I think the media is starting to get it, in part because we are a top campaign by any objective measurement. We're gonna raise more than twice as much money in the third quarter that we did in the second quarter at a time when many other campaigns are starting to shrink. So the campaign is catching on just as the American people are getting more and more excited about me and the campaign. You know, I mean, I don't begrudge anyone their point of view, though I will say that the people that dig into this campaign will find that there's a lot to get excited about, and we're going to make journalists who believed in us early look very good, like you, Paul. So thank you.
Finally, last question. You've come a long way, but you're not in that top tier yet. How do you get there from where you are right now?
The great thing, and this is the numbers of our campaign, the more people dig in to our platform, our ideas for the country, the more excited they get and the better we do. And so a lot of the debates in the fall is going to be continuing to introduce myself to more and more Americans, because most Americans still do not know who I am. And that's one of the reasons why our capacity for growth is so much higher than other campaigns. A lot of other campaigns, their ceiling is sort of baked in, whereas no one knows what our ceiling is, but we're going to find out together.
Andrew Yang there with Paul Steinhauser. As Paul mentioned earlier, we first met with Andrew Yang about a year and a half ago, and you know, we had no idea where his candidacy was headed, and I talked with Yang about that. You don't know where candidates are going to go.
I didn't know
if you were going to have success or not. I liked your message, and the thing that stood out the most is that a lot of the political figures that come in here are reactionary, and you were, in a lot of ways, and this might be a bit of a stretch, but I'm sure you'll take it, a visionary in some ways. In that you
tell my wife.
In that you were looking at the horizon and seeing what the future was going to be in regards to jobs, where America was headed, and your book highlights a lot of that as well. And also speaking in a language that's different than that of the political figures in this race. In some ways, was that what catapulted you to get into this? Where it's always frustrating to me when political figures will take the news of the day and say, oh, gun control, we're going to talk about this today, but we're going to react to what's taking place, as opposed to pushing forth a plan to address not just the issues of today, but of tomorrow.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, where millions of Americans despair that our government is behind the curve, is not answering the real challenges of this time. It's, in my mind, one of the main reasons Donald Trump's our president today, mm-hmm. is that Americans looked up and said, we need something different. Our career politicians are never going to solve these problems because they're just going to react to the headline of the day. They're just going to go to their cable news appearances and fundraising dinners while the problems just get worse and worse. And so, to me, the biggest problems are climate change and the fact that our economy is evolving in ways that it's going to push more and more people here in New Hampshire and around the country to the sidelines. And you can see it manifest in the numbers, but also in the fact that suicides and drug overdoses have now overtaken vehicle deaths, the leading cause of death, first time in American history, to the point where our collective life expectancy has declined for the last right. 3 years. Things are going very badly in many, many communities. That's one of the reasons Donald Trump is our president. So we have to try and solve the real problems on the ground. That's been the approach of my campaign, and I believe it's a reason why we're taking off.
You released a climate policy here in New Hampshire, which takes a look at this from a multifaceted level and is, again, one of those plans that looks towards the future while also addressing things that are taking place today. And I think that I don't quite understand why there's a pushback that ever occurs in regards to green jobs and creating a green economy when we look at where our economy is headed at this point in time. Take us through the particularly that aspect of things and the green jobs side of things and the need for that, given what you've discussed in great detail about where trucking jobs are headed, where automation and artificial intelligence are heading. Are green jobs sustainable jobs as well?
Yeah, that has to be the path forward. We already automated away 4 million manufacturing jobs in Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. And now we're doing the same thing to retail jobs, call center jobs, fast food jobs, and most disastrously, pretty soon, truck driving jobs. Mm-hmm. My friends in California are working on cars and trucks that can drive themselves. While driving a truck is the most common job in New Hampshire and 28 other states, 3.5 million Americans drive trucks for a living. And another 7 million Americans work at truck stops, motels, and diners that rely upon the truckers getting out and having a mm-hmm. meal. So when you see on the horizon that these massive changes are occurring in our economy, and our politicians don't want to touch it. We're in the midst of what experts are calling the fourth industrial revolution. I bet you've never heard a politician say the words fourth industrial mm-hmm. revolution until just now. And I'm barely a politician. So the green jobs, we have to look at it over our history. We've subsidized the fossil fuel industry to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars. And now the unfortunate misconception tug of war we're in is that people look up and say moving towards renewable source of energy will be bad for the economy, it will make things more expensive, it will cost American jobs. But again, one, we subsidize fossil fuels in their infancy, and two, we have to start creating the jobs that are going to help keep our economy moving, including the ability to export some of these green technologies to other countries. And GDP as an economic measuring stick is something we made up almost 100 years ago. And it's the wrong measurement for us today because, right. again, our life expectancy has declined for 3 years in a row while GDP has gone to record highs. And so if you present something to like moving to renewable technologies as like, oh, it's going to be quote unquote bad for the economy, it actually can be very good for the economy.
Yeah, GDP and unemployment rates are the two most annoying data
points. Man, yeah, you're smart enough to know that they're really super misleading. And one of the examples I used earlier today, if a hurricane comes down and knocks down Concord,
you're going to nuke it, right?
No. I wouldn't
just
nuke
like
the hurricane.
President.
But if the hurricane comes and knocks down Concord, New Hampshire, that's actually positive for GDP because we then have to spend a lot of money rebuilding. And so it's like,
right.
ooh, more stuff got produced, which is obviously insane. Like, that doesn't make any sense. So we need to have better measurements that actually include what economists call negative externalities. So if you have fossil fuels that make the earth warmer, that ends up costing trillions of dollars in damage in coastal communities, then who pays for that? Like that has to be the cost you factor in.
How urgent is the need to do something in regards to the climate? And there's some disagreement amongst even scientists on this, but in particular, presidential candidates on this about when we need to act. Jay Inslee was in the race and made this his
signature
issue and said, this is it. Like, the next president, the next 4 to 8 years, if we don't do something to reverse this trend, that's going to be it for the world. Are you in that boat, or do you feel that there is more time, there's more nuance to it? How do you feel?
There's a whole spectrum, Chris. So unfortunately, I am with Jay Inslee and others that things are even worse than most people believe. As a couple of data points, just to throw some out there that just came out, the UN just released a study saying that we're going to be okay if 80% of the world goes vegetarian immediately, which I don't foresee happening. I like my meat too. Another study came out saying that Greenland's ice pack is melting at the rate projected in 2070 today, 51 years earlier. So the data is very daunting. And the last 4 years have been the 4 warmest years in recorded history already. I was just in Portsmouth earlier today, and they told me that 2,000 residences are now flooding regularly. And a multi-million-dollar shrimp business has gone to zero. Mm-hmm. So these changes are real. They're immediate. They're with us right now. If we don't act over the next number of years, certainly climate change is set to accelerate. But the brutal truth is that the United States of America is only 15% of global emissions. So if we were to do everything right within our own borders, but, for example, the Amazon had giant fires that were deforesting it, mm-hmm. and Africa continued to use coal-burning plants and whatnot, unfortunately, we could still be in for an extraordinarily difficult time for Americans, even if we did everything right within our own country.
So building a green world is going to is one of your key components of this, is, in my view, going to require either some sort of a existential type event, which is going to create urgency, or it's going to require a generational change of mindset. Take as an example, paper straws. People grumble about the paper straws or the...
I have to confess, I find the paper straws somewhat irritating. Exactly. They kind of crumble.
I found someone already who... And there's only two people here who doesn't like the paper straws. People, you know, don't want to not have their plastic shopping bags. Just things that people are just used to doing. And again, these are kind of just, you know, existential... Not existential. These are very small aspects of a greener world. But people don't like to change their habits. And so it's going to require a instilling of a younger generation, new habits, trying to get, you know, individuals who are my age and older to change their habits. So how does that take place? And how do you start to turn the tide of something that's been, you know, going on for many years?
No, it's interesting, Chris, and this is one of the reasons why I think climate change gets a bad rap. Because frankly, if you were to come to me and say, hey, your job is to stop eating meat, just use plastic straws and never use a plastic bag, then I'm going to find it mildly irritating at best. You know, it's going to be like, oh, that's a drag. It's not about...
And you're likely to push back and say, why? Why do I trust this information that you're giving me?
Right. What we have to do is we have to try and focus on the biggest sources of emission and climate change, which... frankly, is probably not, you know, my plastic bag at the grocery store.
Right.
You know,
but vehicles and travel.
Yes. You got to go to where the needle moving can be very significant very quickly.
Power.
Another part about building a greener world is that we have these massive fires in the Amazon with the lungs of the world and supply 20% of the world's oxygen. We need to go to some parts of the world that are up for this, which will be many of them, and say, look, we'd like to plant a lot of trees in some of your emptier tracts of land. Mm-hmm. And guess what? We'll pay you a little bit of money to mind the woodlands that we're leaving behind, and we're going to do this because it's positive for the environment and there'll be a carbon offset involved. We have to stop not just trying to do less of the bad. We have to do more of the good. There's a study that just came out that said the Atlantic Ocean is losing 4 to 8% of its biomass every year, which is a catastrophe. And it's part of the reason why some of the coastal communities are now having to shift their or abandon their fishing businesses. So we need to start reseeding the ocean with microalgae that can help revitalize some of the ecosystems. So it's not just, hey, let's irritate the heck out of everyone and, like, you know, mm-hmm. like just make everyone's life a little bit more annoying. It's let's go to where the numbers are big and try and solve problems in a way that'll actually preserve the earth more effectively.
That is Andrew Yang. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Mayor Pete Buttigieg saw big crowds as he crisscrossed the Granite State this past weekend, and I sat down with him in Hanover. We are on the campaign trail in Hanover, New Hampshire, the Hanover Inn. Honored to be joined by Mayor Pete Buttigieg as he joins us here on the program after a packed event here at the Hanover Inn. 635 total, including 285 in the overflow room, and we'll start with some process questions, and I'm very interested in your mental health plan, which is a big priority for me on the program, which we're going to get into in depth. But you are a candidate that is positioned well, in my view, to win the nomination. You're right where you want to be in terms of financing. Poll numbers show upwards mobility but have a stable base. What is the strategy, though, to get to the finish line?
Well, what I'm finding is that the campaign has now entered the phase where it's about the often unglamorous work that's being done on the ground by organizers. So in addition to me continuing to visit the state, shore up support, try to earn new voters and gear up for the home stretch that's coming next year, a big part of what's happening is that the organizers we've been hiring are on the ground forming the relationships that I think really pay off in those critical final days. And you got to have both of those. And we have a new organizing model that's really based on relationships that I think serves us very well. We are right where we want to be, but we know there's a lot of work to do to get from here to the top of the heap.
Do you need to pick a state, Iowa or New Hampshire, and prioritize there and not neglect the other one, but to ensure a better than expected finish, you know, that strong second in Iowa propelling you here to New Hampshire? How do you need to prioritize one state or the other, do you think?
I don't think it's an either or. You really need to show well in both, because I think in many ways that whole season, that stretch of days that include the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary is when so many people, even in some of the other early states, really tune in and take your measure. So we definitely need to do well in both, and we're organizing accordingly.
Yeah, and when I think about it, Iowa's obviously a good state for you, and a better than expected finish there, along with a strong effort here in New Hampshire on the ground, could, you know, propel you moving forward here as well. So probably a balanced approach may be a good one for you.
That's right, and there are advantages to each. Iowa is in the Midwest. It's within driving distance of my house, and the caucus style of politics, I think, really matches nicely some of what I'm used to as a mayor. By contrast, New Hampshire has some interesting qualities, including the way that independents play a role in the process, that I think is also a chance to demonstrate not only that we can move from a caucus environment to a primary environment, but also that we can draw in some of those independent voices that are clearly looking for a direction other than the current president.
Yeah, and I'm one of those voices, so we'll get to that in a second, how you're going to try to gain the support of independents. But actually, I think that this is one of the ways that you can do it, is mental health is a huge issue, and I think one of the biggest, if not the biggest public health epidemics that we're facing, when you consider all the different ways that it affects our society. When you ask the why of why certain things ail our society, a lot of times it goes back to mental health. And your plan includes $100 billion over a 10-year period, and in my view, really seeks to present parity between physical and mental health.
That's right.
So how do you go about implementing it, and do you see mental health as being the number one public health epidemic facing our country?
Well, it's certainly a major issue, and there are several health challenges that we're facing, but some get talked about more than others. Mm-hmm. We need to bring mental health and addiction out of the shadows. I think some people still hesitate to talk about it, and we've got to let people struggling with these issues know you have nothing to be ashamed of, and we're going to line up the resources to get you the support you need, especially young people, people who, if we can identify some of these issues early in life, we have a much better chance of treating and catching them before they develop into a bigger problem as people grow older. It's why we're talking about it so prominently in the campaign, and it's why we want to invest in communities' ability to come up with their own approaches, their own solutions, knowing that it'll be different from one part of the country to the other, but in every part of the country, we have a need to tackle mental health and addiction concerns.
So what does implementation look like? Do you invest in your community mental health organizations and allow for them to do work within communities? And a lot of the rural areas in our nation don't have those types of community mental health facilities. So do you have to build out infrastructure? What does a plan look like in terms of practicality and implementation.
That's right. It really is going to vary, and that's why we're trying to have it not be one size fits all. Mm-hmm. In a place like South Bend, for example, we have a two hospitals serving mm-hmm. the city. One of the biggest needs we have is that people in the hospitals might wake up having recovered from or been brought back from an overdose and face several weeks before they can see a provider for an appointment. We need to fund people who will walk with them on that journey of staying healthy between then and when somebody can see them while working to reverse the provider shortage. In an area of rural New Hampshire, the challenge may be that we have telemedicine and telepsychiatry options that would benefit somebody mm-hmm. in a rural area, but they don't have the broadband that they need. So we would fund a way to at least transport them to a hub that might be in their community, if not yet in their home, that has the access and has a link to somebody who can see them remotely sooner than we can get them to see somebody in person. We know that it's going to vary, but mm-hmm. we also know that every community knows best what its own needs are.
I think the aspect of telehealth or using an interface is integral in all aspects of healthcare. Mental health, I think, is a huge piece of that because it allows for peer-to-peer support, and it allows for individuals who are having a mental health crisis to reach a person when they need to. And the past structure of mental health was you go in, you sit down on the couch with an individual once a week on Tuesday at 2 p.m. And Tuesday at 2 p.m. generally isn't when you're having a mental health crisis. It's during the middle of the night. So in terms of, we'll kind of go into a broader look at your healthcare plan. You described it as Medicare for all who want it.
Right.
How much of that is changing the way healthcare is delivered right now? Because a lot of it is payment based upon encounters, where the person goes in to see the psychologist, when they go in to see the orthopedic surgeon for a consult.
That's right.
How does this go about changing the healthcare system, taking out some of the bureaucracy and the pay structure?
Well, what we know is that the current structure incentivizes lots of visits and lots of tests,
correct,
but doesn't always incentivize the kind of early detection or routine visits that might head off the bigger issues down the road. That would create a huge savings for society and for the program, but isn't always what the system is set up to reward. So we do need to move from a sickness care system to,
right,
a healthcare system, and we need to move from treating illnesses to treating patients.
So when I look at Medicare for All, the plan that Bernie and Elizabeth Warren pushed forth, I see the same problems that you addressed today, where it just doesn't make sense in the way that our country is structured. And if we were starting a new country, I think that's a good, Medicare for All is a good plan, but we're not starting a new country. And individuals want to keep, at this point in their view, and they're right, their employer-based healthcare plans. Also, taking the insurance, private insurance, out of the marketplace would create a huge effect on our economy. So, how is your plan different than their plan? And what do you see as being the roadmap to implementation?
So the biggest difference is just that. I don't think you can flip a switch, throw everybody off their private health care, and expect them to thrive or expect that to work. I do think that we need to move toward universal health care, but you can't just do it overnight. So what we need to do is create an alternative, and that's what the Medicare for All Who Want It plan is designed to be. Something that is based on Medicare but improves upon it and is available for anybody to get into. Now, I think that will be a more attractive option for coverage than any of the corporate private plans that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a chance to see whether that's actually true. So we create the alternative, and if people like me are right, then people will vote with their feet and move to that option.
Mm-hmm.
If, on the other hand, the public competition motivates the private options to do better than they have before, to cover us better and make it more affordable, well, that's a good thing too. It's not what I expect, but this option creates room for that possibility.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. This past Sunday, I was in Laconia for the Belknap County Dems Blue Bash, and I sat down with U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota.
Joined by U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar here in Laconia, and your campaign is one that, in my view, has huge upwards mobility potential in a lot of different states. New Hampshire is one of them, and I'm curious, as you move forward, how do you, determine what the state is going to be that you're going to invest in, or are you going to try to, do Iowa and then see for a bounce, look for a bounce in New Hampshire? Do you feel like you have to pick one state, in other words?
No, and you can't win by just doing Iowa. I mean, maybe one time long, long ago that was true. So I'm really proud of the grassroots team we're putting together here, led by Scott Merrick from the North Country, who is a legislator and worked for Senator Shaheen and has a lot of experience. He just got engaged this weekend. Just want to plug that. Given that I announced,
congrats.
Yeah, he was engaged at Politics and Eggs, and he wasn't yet. I feel really happy about this. So a lot of this is New Hampshire is very similar to my state of Minnesota, and I can relate to the politics in a funny way. I'm close with Jeannie and Maggie in terms of how I vote and how I view your job of governing. And also, you've got to win everywhere. You can't win in every state, but you've got to make a big, big effort in New Hampshire. That's why we built up our team. We've opened an office. That's why we are getting all over the state. This is my second visit to this area. I'm head of the tourism caucus. I get that piece of it. And also understand how not one size fits all. In Laconia versus, say, Manchester or Boston, right? Mm-hmm. And you have to see that there's different needs for education and healthcare and rural broadband and you name it. And that's a message that I'm taking on the road, as well as people are sick of this guy whining in the White House. Mm-hmm. They really are. They want to see someone who's going to be straight with them and be honest about our challenges and get things done.
Yeah, the candidates that have had success here in New Hampshire generally have been ones that have really partook in the grind that is politicking here in
New
Hampshire.
You
mentioned John McCain. You never know what's going to happen. And
remember when his campaign was like really down? And then
July of 07.
Yeah, and then he just came here and he went everywhere and just kind of started fresh and showed that he had that grit to do it. And I think that's part of the journey that we are on right now, because our campaign is actually gaining speed. Mm-hmm. But I started in the middle of that blizzard and had to prove myself coming from a state that's not as big as some of the other candidate states. Some of these other people, like Bernie next door, have been running for president for a really long time. And that's not me. I've been someone that has been doing my job, feel like I have something big to offer the nation, and that is a different plane of our politics, which is to bridge the river of our divide and get to a higher plane. That's what I've been doing.
Let's talk a little about the economy, as there's been increasing signs that we're headed potentially towards a recession. And I'm curious as to what you're seeing in regards to the economy, what you're feeling is, and particularly the impact that the Trump tariffs have had on the economy as a whole.
Well, I hope that we are not headed to a recession. No one wants that. But what concerns me is, because the president makes decisions just for the next minute and how he's concerned about the effect on Twitter as opposed to the long term, I do get concerned that we're not doing enough to shore up things for the long term. He's added greatly to the debt. That's why I voted against his tax bill, because it contributed over $1 trillion to the debt. He has not taken care of negotiating with our allies when it comes to China. We have over $790 billion trade deficit now. He is not taking care of pharmaceutical prices, college prices, you name it. And I think you need someone that is going to actually go in there and do the hard work it takes to take on these issues. You cannot negotiate with China by tweet. You cannot solve climate change by just standing at a rally and saying it isn't happening and making fun of it. Mm-hmm. You actually have to do the hard work it takes to get it done.
In conclusion, one of the major discussions taking place in the Democratic Party right now is if our country is fundamentally flawed at this point in time. Even looking back to the founding of our country, Beto O'Rourke talking about racism and how that we were a nation founded on racism. I talked with Pete Buttigieg, and he said that was true to a large degree. And obviously, this event looking at women's suffrage and the 100th anniversary of women gaining the right to vote. So all these things are facts. And our nation has been on, obviously, a journey. But do you look at our country and see a country that is fundamentally flawed and needs changing from the ground up, or a nation that has problems but is the greatest country and we need to continue on the path that we're on?
I look at our founding. I look at those words, strive for a more perfect union.
Mm-hmm.
That is what we have always done, generation to generation. No, it wasn't perfect. There were all kinds of problems when it was founded. We know that. There were things they wanted in the Constitution that didn't get in there. But you just keep working. That's what the 19th Amendment was, giving mm-hmm. women the right to vote. That's what we've seen with court cases and Brown v. Board of Education mm-hmm. To allow African-American kids to go to the same school as white kids. Every single generation, we rise to the challenge. And it's never easy, but it happens. That's what concerns me about Donald Trump.
Yeah, does a second term change that trajectory in your view?
It makes it, with the attacks on our democracy, with the fact that he's not working on climate change, which mm-hmm. could be the existential threat of our time, with that he's getting out of all these international agreements that have been so important part of, look at Bretton Woods, New Hampshire, mm-hmm. and your veterans here. That's what really worries me. It is not Americans. It is that we as Americans have to stand up for America and the kind of America we want. And we saw that in 2018 with the check and balance on him, and now we need to replace him. And we do it best if we do it by bringing people with us. And that's independents, moderate Republicans with Democrats, and we say, we see a different country. We want to work on these challenges, and that's the kind of ticket I want to lead and the kind of country.
Amy Klobuchar right there also talked with Marianne Williamson.
If you had to fundamentally define what your candidacy is about, the most important aspect of it, how would you do it?
The important aspect of my candidacy is the idea that we as citizens can reclaim this country for genuine democratic principle. We're not now acting as a democracy. We're acting as an oligarchy or a corporatocracy, where our public policy is geared more towards advocating for short-term profits for huge multinational corporations than it is advocating for us and for the planet on which we live. And as a consequence, we have huge amounts of unnecessary human suffering both here and around the world. And we need a fundamental pattern disruption, both socially, economically, and politically. I don't believe that that will come from the political status quo, even a better version of the political status quo. The political status quo will not repair itself. It's time for the people to step in.
So you see yourself as a vehicle for average, everyday, grassroots, if you will, Americans to lead the country? Are you a vehicle or conduit for them?
You know, I don't believe in all those categories.
Mm-hmm.
We're all Americans. There is no everyday. If you're an American, you're an American.
Right.
There is no everyday American. What's the opposite of an everyday American? Every other day
Paul
American?
Hodes.
Yeah, no, we don't. We're not supposed to do that here. It's not supposed to be about whether we're rich, whether we're poor, whether we're black, whether we're white, whether we're brown, whether we're... We're not supposed to do that here. But I do feel that I'm a conduit for the conscience of America in terms of a desire for political change.
Do you see yourself making the next round of debates? And if not, what is the path forward?
Well, I made the 130,000 donors, and now there's this very opaque process. Who are these people? There are 17 DNC-designated polls. Four of them have come out. We don't even know if the rest of them will come out. No, they give no information about who they poll. It's this mysterious process, and we're going to let that be the gatekeeper? I have a problem with that. I'm running for president. I'm not running for DNC darling, which obviously I'm not. I'm running for the presidency of the United States. I have a radical faith in democracy. I believe the people should decide. So I don't know if I'll make that third debate. I hope I will, but, you know, it's these polls, whatever they are. And then if I don't, I'll still have a chance to make it into the fourth debate. I'm here as long as I feel that I'm giving a message that is being heard, as long as the American people are telling me, you go, girl, I'm going.
That's Marianne Williamson. You've been listening to On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.
Hi, I'm Brendan Williams with the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. We're proud to sponsor this program, especially as Granite State residents get to know presidential candidates. New Hampshire has the nation's second oldest population and great nursing home care. Yet Medicaid underfunding jeopardizes care. Roughly 91% of frontline caregivers are women, and here in New Hampshire, they're caring for the nation's second highest proportion of women nursing home residents, many of whom are 95 and older. While our association seeks state solutions, listeners should ask presidential candidates for federal strategies too. Medicaid doesn't cover full care costs, while Medicare just covers long-term care for a limited time, and only if you just spent 3 days in a hospital. How will the candidates address the funding needs of our aging society? At the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, we believe in honoring care and those providing it. Enjoy listening to this program, and be sure to look for real answers from candidates.